Hey, welcome in. This is your boy, Doug Gottlieb, and you're listening to the All Ball Podcast. Got a great guest for you. We'll get to a little bit later on the pod. I want to share with you my thoughts on two things. One, something Roy Williams said about his team, and just kind of an overall sense in college basketball, plus some more NBA tidbits before we get to our guest this week. By the way, you can listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, on your iHeartRadio app, on Fox Sports Radio or foxsportsradio.com, or on your terrestrial, that's like your average radio, or SiriusXM 217 or 203. So Roy Williams said basically this is the least talented team that he's ever had, and it's not wrong. And while people are pointing out, hey, there's four stars and five stars still on the roster, even without Cole Anthony, the fact remains that you lose far and away your best freshman, okay? And you lose, I'm not sure people have a healthy respect for how hard it is to hit reset, you know? Because think about what they lost from last season. Last season's team was good. I think he did a great job of getting them to play, you know, together, considering you had young players and old players kind of all mixed together. But think about this for a second now, okay? You lose Cameron Johnson, Kobe White, Luke May, Nas Little, right? And, I mean, you lose your four absolute best players. It's not really close. Not even close to being close, right? In addition to which, you know, you lose Kenny Williams to graduation. So you lose your five leading scorers. It's crazy. Right, lose your five leading scorers, and you know remarkably the sixth best scorer on last year's team was Garrison Brooks, who's averaging 14 a game for you. A couple of things: one, you lose your point guard. This is how you're going to look. It's not like if you lose your quarterback, you know, you look like an inferior coach. Think about Dabo Sweeney. What did Dabo look like when before he had Deshaun Watson? And now that he has Trevor Lawrence, and what he'd look like when, you know, go through all the other Clemson quarterbacks who are good, but they're just not elite. And elite quarterbacks make you look like an elite coach. But I don't know if everybody thinks they're equipped for the one and done. Remember, they lost two one and dones. Do I think Nasir Little not playing, you know, only playing 18 minutes a game hurt him in terms of recruiting? Probably a little bit. But whatever was hurt by Nasir Little is helped by Kobe White, who he gave a complete green light to, right? So it's still Carolina. It's a competitive field. I think this kind of relates to the bigger question about where'd all the players go in college basketball, right? Where are all the – and this is what happens when there's a Memphis who gets a James Wiseman. This is what happens when a couple players go to play overseas, that all of a sudden now, you know, look, on a given year – there are anywhere between 5 and 15 great freshmen. 5 and 15. And when you lose, you know, three of them to overseas or not playing in college, the rest gets spread out. Arizona's got a really young squad. They have a couple of them. Go around the country. And look, you know, Nova's got a really young squad mixed in with some older pieces, but they don't have any, like, kind of breakthrough prolific talents. Kentucky has, what, one and some other freshmen. Duke has one and maybe, you know, and Vernon Carey and Cassius Stanley, I guess, you know. Now Louisville's a player in the elite. So when you have Louisville, Kentucky, North Carolina, Duke, Memphis, Arizona, I know I'm forgetting a couple, all fighting over the same kind of small group of stars, and you lose a couple off the top, and James Wiseman's not playing, and Cole Anthony gets hurt. And, oh, yeah, by the way, there are second-level guys who left school early to go to the pros or got upset at a lack of playing time or not being the first-level guys, and they transferred, and they're sitting out. It's not one thing that's led to college basketball being a lot like North Carolina. Right, Roy Williams' argument for this being the least talented team, it's inarguable. In number of NBA players in comparison to any other time he's coached at Carolina and probably most any other time he's been at Kansas. I would also say, though, the sport is really, really spread out. It's lacking the top-end talent. And even not just the top-end talent, that second-tier talent has also, you know, transferred, left, whatever. because it was unhappy, or gone to the NBA because it thought, you know. I mean, look at Iowa State losing two players who don't even have two-way contracts. You know, of course, Iowa State gets blown out. That's why Kansas is the elite team in the Big 12, because they've been able, because Udoka Azubuike, one, got hurt, and two, because his position is really not as desirable in the NBA. You know, and the rest of their team is made up of good, not great players. They've kind of nailed it in that maybe it's not the greatest thing to get the top-level recruits, but if you can get guys and play them and keep them in school, you got a chance to be really good. So I guess the ending statement to what Roy Williams is saying, and look, it's a challenge to recruiting. You have to change when it's a lot of, some teams can survive without a point guard. But if your system is really point guard dependent, usually, which is North Carolina's is, calls the offenses, calls the defense, and then the buildup of this team was completely built around Cole Anthony, then you lose him. And you lost your top five scorers from last year. You lost both old and mature and your culture setters, and you lost your new up-and-comers. This is what happens, and this is the challenge of college basketball. And the question becomes, how do you fix it? Right? How do you fix it? Because I know there's a group of people that, well, listen, you're just compensating for name and likeness. They'll stay. Like, no, they won't, because they're not chasing after thousands. They're chasing after millions, even if the millions aren't really there. I feel like we're in this realm where everyone knows the G League is coming on strong, and they're going to start at some point. Someone is going to decide, hey, I'm not going to play in college. I'm going to play in the G League. I don't think it'll go well for them, but they'll still probably get drafted or whatever. Remember, people have been able to do that since the G League was the D League. But I do feel like the G League is coming on strong from a perception standpoint. And we're kind of downplaying what Zion Williamson said this week, which is, you know, truth be told, I would have rather stayed at Duke. I was having a lot of fun. And I'm not sure, even if he has a bunch of money, if he's having all that much fun. I kind of think that's the part that needs to be relayed to basketball people and parents, but especially to the players. Like, look, you're going to make money. If you're really good, you're always going to have a job. But this is the most fun you're ever going to have. And you just don't have nearly as much fun playing in the NBA or playing overseas or playing in the G League. So college basketball is in a weird place. I'm not totally sure how to fix it. I think the NBA is going to try and do what is in the best interest of the NBA, and they don't feel like it is keeping kids in college. It's going to be sending guys to the G League. But the G League isn't coached by nearly as good of coaches. They don't practice as hard. The level of talent is better. The style of basketball is different. There is no fan support. There is no TV. People don't watch it on TV. You're losing a bunch of it. But we're in this weird transition period where college basketball seems to be slipping on some level to the level of college baseball. The difference, obviously, is there's still really, really good talent, still really, really good coaches. There's incredible resources, the practice facilities, the lower end of the coaching in terms of the assistants and the GAs. Like, those guys are great workers, and there's a greater depth of resources than they have for the G League. But the top-end talent is just not there. One, because of the season. Two, because of now you go through 3 or 4 years of anybody with a pulse going to the NBA draft, and a couple of guys going overseas, and a couple of guys getting hurt, and one guy choosing to withdraw from college after playing a handful of games. And here we are.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
All right, let's catch up with him. He's a native of Sugar Land, Texas, which, of course, Houston, Texas. And then he went and played at Bradley. He's an assistant coach at TCU following a stint at UCLA. He's Dwayne Broussard. He joins us in the All Ball podcast. Coach, give me what we would go back. Man, this is going back a long time. Your first memory of hoop was what?
Maybe 4 or 5 years of age, when my father came home one day and had a basketball in the backseat of his car and handed it over to me and said, hey, if you're going to play, then you're going to have to work at it, but here's the ball, so get to work.
Did your dad play?
First, you know what? No, not in college, but played a little bit in high school and some rec leagues when he was older. Good player, but never had a chance to play in college.
Well, what do you do for a living?
I'm sorry. What you broke up, Doug. I'm sorry.
That's okay. What did he do for a living?
So he went to college on a swimming scholarship. He went to Grambling State University. And then from there, he was drafted into the armed forces, went to Germany, and then served time there. That's where I was born, and then came back to the United States with my mother, and then ended up having a 35-year career with Harris County Probations at Houston, Texas, and has been retired now, I think, for about 12 years.
So he was a parole officer, or did he serve it? Did he work in the jails?
He was a probation officer. So, parole is after you get out of the penitentiary, and I think he was before that stage. So that's what he did, probation officer for a long time in Houston. So, and very successful, very good man. Taught me a lot about life. It still does to this very day. So I'm very proud to be his son.
You're a hell of a player, right? You go to Bradley and play. What was he like, you know, in terms of you? And I know through your travels as an assistant coach, you see all kinds of dads in terms of their involvement.
Right.
And it's weird. It's weird because some dads, you know, like my dad, probably overly involved,
right.
And that's become a little bit more of the norm. You know, not all the kids have a mom and dad in their home, but the ones that do, the moms and dads are really, really involved. What was he like during your basketball career?
He was really involved. He gave me a lot of insight, taught me a lot about the game. And there were times, as you can imagine, Doug, and I'm sure you were like this, where I probably didn't want to hear what he had to say, because sometimes I thought he could be a little overcritical. But at the end of the day, I knew he meant well and he loved me. So, and that's why to this day, if it's not basketball, because I'm a basketball coach, if it's something about life, I do listen to him. I really do. I listen to him. So, but he helped me a lot. Helped me a lot about playing the position of point guard and understanding players and how to build relationships and build trust. And those lessons have certainly helped me in my profession right now at this very moment. So very, 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 very fortunate to have had him in my ear, you know?
Yeah. Why'd you go to Bradley?
Well, Bradley at the time was coming off a couple of successful years, because I was coming right behind Hersey Hawkins and Jim Bless, and had never really been to the upper Midwest to visit. And during the AAU seasons, when I would play in the summertime, whenever I would run across individuals or players from that part of the country, they were always and almost always the ones that were most difficult to guard and play against. So I figured, okay, if I'm playing against these individuals and I'm not having a whole lot of success, then maybe I'll go up there and learn how to play like that. And Bradley was very forthcoming in their interest of me and had a position for me. And it was a private school, and I loved the living situation. And it just worked out. You know, it worked out. I had other schools at the time recruiting me, but Bradley was the one that made the most sense at the time. And that's why I went to school there.
So you went to go play for Stan Elbeck, right? What was he like?
I did. I played for Stan Elbeck. Yeah, I played for Stan Elbeck for 2 years, my first 2 years there. And that was good. You know, it was a different brand of basketball than what I was accustomed to. You know, kind of more open and more fast-paced. And to be quite honest with you, if you check the record books, we weren't very good our first 2 years there at Bradley. And Stan left, and then in comes Jim Molinari. And I played for Jim Molinari for my last 2 years, and eventually ended up working for him as a coach for 9 years. So Jim Molinari and I are great friends today. He's like a big brother to me. So for those last 2 years, I learned a different brand of basketball there, Doug. I learned how to play defense. And
So I don't know if you know this, but Jim Molinari, of course, went to Kansas State. My dad signed him to go to play Kansas State under Jack Hartman.
Exactly.
So obviously, and Coach Mull now is at Oklahoma. All right, your first couple years you're going up and down.
Yes.
Not a lot of success. Jim Molinari comes in, and you know how it works nowadays. You've been a part of new staffs. New staffs generally, mm-hmm. you run guys off, and you bring in your own guys. What was it like when Jim Molinari first got the job? Did he try and run you off?
No. As a matter of fact, it was just the opposite. And he'll tell you a story if you ever talk to him. When you take over a new job, obviously as a coach, you interview all the players and all the support staff, and you kind of get a feel for what's in place. And fortunately for me, every player that he interviewed, all of my teammates, said, "You should keep Dwayne. You should keep Dwayne." Okay. And I think because I was a well-liked individual. And so I stayed. And that's kind of how it all happened with me continuing my career and getting a college degree from Bradley. You know, I was a little nervous because of the coaching change, but it all worked out. I mean, it all worked out. And I was a starter my junior year, and then there was a crop of freshmen that came in my senior year, and I started half the season, and then the second half of my senior year, I came off the bench as a six-man, which was perfectly fine because we became a really, really good team. And then when I started coaching, I mean, we were really, really good. So it all worked out. You know, it all worked out, and I was fortunate and pleased to have had a chance to stay and be on coach's staff and be on his team. So it all worked out. It was good.
All right, I want to get to a couple of things you learned during the bad years. I think it was your sophomore year. You guys were 8-20. Your best player was a guy named Curtis Stuckey. He averaged 25 a game.
Curtis Stuckey. Yes.
Right? Okay, yeah. How can a guy average 25 a game in the Valley and you guys be so bad? Why did you not win?
Well, I think we had less of an attention to detail in the defensive end. You know, I think we probably had some chemistry issues, and I think those two were the main things. Quite honestly, I think, you know, we probably had, you know, players that didn't work on their game enough, and as a result, didn't get any better. So I think that's what happens, and that's what typically happens. You know, players aren't as good as they need to be, and you know, there's no chemistry, and people don't want to work together, if I recall, and that's what happened, and we collapsed. You know,
your senior year, you mentioned you started coming off the bench. You had a freshman named Deion Jackson, another freshman named Billy Wright, right?
So, yes.
But what's that like to be? Wait, you've been here 4 years. You've been through all of it. Like, do you remember the emotions of the time? Were you really good with it? Were you really that good a teammate?
Well, initially, no, it was an embarrassing thing, but I had forged such a great relationship with Coach Molinari and his staff, and I think on that particular staff, Rob Judson, who's now at Marquette, and then Richard McKay was on that staff, who is now at Liberty, doing a phenomenal job. They pulled me in and told me this would be best for our program. And so, and my leadership ability wouldn't be impacted. So, you know, I bit the bullet, Doug, and accepted my role, and it worked out for the betterment of the team. You know, I still didn't play as much. I wasn't playing 27 minutes a game, but I still recall that in crucial moments, I was on the floor. And at times, Billy Wright, who's now the head coach at Western Illinois, who's a really good friend of mine, he's like a brother to me, was well-deserving of that position. He was. He was well-deserving. He had come off of winning a state championship in the state of Indiana at Richmond High School and was very, very good. There's no doubt, very, very good. And so it's just something that happened and needed to take place, and it was good. Like I said, we ended up – we had a streak in the second half of the season where – and my numbers may be wrong, Doug, but I think our last nine games, we won seven of them.
Do you want to know? Because I do have it in front of me. If you'd like to know.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're. So let's see here. It started. Let's see here. You were 8-3. Let me just make sure this is the right year here. Sorry, that's Coach Mall's second year. So Coach Mall's, what, his?
So you're it would have been 92-93.
Right. You were 92-93. You guys finished up 7-11 in Valley play. At one point in the year, you were 5-14, right? But you won five of your last six.
Okay, five or last six. Was right. You beat Indiana State.
You beat Indiana State on the road. You held them to 36 points, right?
That's exactly right. I remember that.
You beat Tulsa. It was really good. You beat Tulsa. You beat Illinois State. You lost to Drake.
Right.
You beat Northern by like almost 30. Then you beat DePaul in a non-conference game of the season. And then you lost in overtime to Southern Illinois.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. And then the following year is when it all just kind of came together. And I was still a part of that team. I was a coach then, and I was a director of operations. So it was good. That piece was good.
All right, so you get done playing. How did it come about that you stayed on staff? Do you remember? Did you guys have a meeting when your career was over? What did you approach Coach Mo about it? How did it work?
No, that's so funny story. Little tidbit here. I had been interviewed my senior year, the second half of my senior year. I had been interviewed by the United States Secret Service three times, because that was the direction I was going to go into. I was going to go work for the Secret Service. And if I didn't do that, then I had an opportunity to go to law school in Texas. So I was going to do something in law enforcement because that was my background. So when I graduated, I think May 15th of that year, I was all set to come back home to Houston and spend about a week or two. And then was going to go off and do all of my education and training with the Secret Service. That's what I was getting ready to do. We had a coaching change. Rich McKay left and went to Washington. And I went home on a Sunday. I graduated on a Saturday. I went home on a Sunday. On Tuesday, Coach Mo called me. He just called me and says, I have a plane ticket for you at Hobby Airport in Houston. It's time for you to come back here and start your coaching career. And I'm like, oh, that's what it's going to be. And that's how it started. That's exactly how it started. I called the Secret Service and said, I'm out. And I let the people know at St. Mary's Law School in San Antonio, Texas, that I was not going to be attending. And that's how it happened. That's exactly how it happened. And that was 25 years ago, maybe 26 years ago. That's what happened.
What was your salary your first year? Do you remember?
Well, I was a restricted earnings coach, and so you, being well-versed in all of college athletics, I mean, you understand that terminology.
Yep.
I was allowed to, I think, make no more than $24,000 a year, but it wasn't that. It was a lot less than that. It was probably somewhere in the teens, if I recall. So wasn't a lot, but I was very fortunate and very thankful. Working for my alma mater and working for Coach Molinari. So it was a good situation. It was a really good situation.
How did that relationship evolve? You know, he didn't recruit you. You become a player. You're his starting point guard. Then you come off the bench for him. Then he hires you as a coach. Like, these are different ways in which, how did it evolve? Now you're an assistant coach, you know, right out of college. What was your relationship like with Jim?
Well, I trusted him. I trusted him, and I think part of the reason I trusted him so much is because he had proven himself to be a great man of integrity. You know, his faith, which we connected on a spiritual level that way, it taught me a lot about life, you know, through his faith and through his integrity. And even though I may not have played the minutes that a junior or senior would sometimes deserve because of all the sacrifices that you go through, I still was an integral part of the team and had a tremendous leadership role. And I think that's where he saw something in me that would allow me to be able to become a coach. Okay. I had a tremendous relationship with the young guys, and he thought, even though we were teammates, Doug, there was still enough separation in age where if I needed to convey a message or get across instructions, that I would still hold and have the respect of my former teammates and now the guys that I was coaching. He saw that in me, and he empowered me to be that way with our young players. So that forged our relationship even more.
Your best player was your first year was a freshman named Anthony Parker. He
yes.
went on to become, you know, in the conversation. There's been some great players at Bradley, obviously mm-hmm. historically. Anybody who's been to Peoria knows how big Bradley basketball is and, mm-hmm. and what a great basketball mm-hmm. town it is. Mm-hmm. You're a first year coach. What were your initial impressions of Anthony Parker?
I hosted him on his recruiting visit. So the year before, when I was a senior, he came to campus, and I found him to be a very intelligent, quick-witted, very talented individual. You know, I had watched film on him and had kind of saw his skill set, but had no idea that he would evolve and develop into the player that he was at Bradley. But initially, I thought he would be a really good fit for us because he was exactly what we needed at the time. We didn't necessarily have a primary score at his position. And so it was a great fit, you know, and he was just below the high major, qualification. You know, he probably could have went to a high major school, but may not have been able to play his freshman year and gain all that experience and confidence that he did that allowed him to be so good for us. But I knew in our system, I just had a feeling that he would end up being a pretty good player, you know, and not to mention his siblings, you know, like, yeah. I remember this like it was yesterday. It's like, I remember Candace when she was really, really little, you know, and then it all has kind of evolved, and now she's one of the best players ever in women's basketball. So, but great family, you know, great family. So he was a good fit, Doug, is what I'm saying. That's how I knew it would possibly work. And we needed him for that position. So,
I know the Valley ended up having later on, you know, when you go to the late 90s, early 2000s, had maybe more overall success in the tournament, but that was probably the golden era of the Valley, right? I mean, you had several different coaches. Tubby, obviously, in the mid-90s had Tulsa, right. And they were playing fast. You guys were winning 20 a game. Mm-hmm. You know, Missouri State, when you had Spoon there, obviously was winning mm-hmm. a ton of games. What was the toughest place to play as a player, as a coach in those days of the Valley?
Well, I think you just mentioned them. So Tulsa, because they had such tradition, was very difficult to play in. I mean, the fans were just amazingly into games and very knowledgeable. Missouri State, which was at the time Southwest Missouri State, was also tough because the fans were right on top of you, right on top of you. So that was pretty tough. And even Wichita State, I can't recall that Wichita State was kind of in a decline then. I can't remember, but I know it was still difficult to play there. Southern Illinois was difficult to play at, and even Illinois State. You know, you think back on it, with Kevin Stallings and what he was able to do there, it was just fascinating. And I think that's what made the Valley so competitive. It was a great basketball league. It had great fan support. You were on TV, and I think you had a level of talent that, for that particular league, was outstanding. It was just completely outstanding, you know. So not to mention you had Creighton, and then Northern Iowa was pretty good as well. So it was really good. It was very fun to play in and to coach in. So
why did you guys lose momentum?
That's a really good question. I think... I think when you, for a long period of time, when you recruit a certain area, and I think the talent level in that area that we were recruiting kind of waned a little bit.
Which is where, like downstate Illinois, is that? Yeah.
Well, Bradley's Central Illinois, Central Illinois. And, you know, we had some really good teams like Manuel. I'm sure you've heard about Manuel. had the likes of, you know, Frankie Williams and Sergio McClain. But they all went
to Illinois.
Exactly. We were never going to get those players. You know, we were just never going to get those players. So I think, you know, not being able to recruit the same way and other places just getting better and having more of a run and things just happen that way. So I think that's just kind of how it all went down.
When you have to leave, it's one thing to leave a program where you coached for 9 years, but you played there for 4 years. That's 13 years at one place.
Yeah.
What do you remember about the emotions of leaving Bradley?
It was frightening, you know, and I think by the time that I left Bradley, I might have been married for 3 years, and my wife is from Peoria, and all of her family's there. So it was frightening on the one end, but on the horizon, we could see great adventure on the other. And so, and then I was leaving a man who I had entrusted my life to basically for the past 13, 14 years, you know, maybe 12 years because I only played for 2 years, but so it was scary, but exciting at the same time. So it worked out, you know, it all worked out. So
it did. So Danny Granger was the best young player in Bradley's program. You guys get fired. What happened next?
Right. So then I went to New Mexico. Actually, I went to Oregon State because Richie McKay had done such an incredible job, an amazing job at Colorado State, I think. And then he had went to Oregon State and was there. And so he hired me at Oregon State for 2 months. And then after that, he got interest from New Mexico, went to New Mexico, and then we went there. So then I spent the next 11 years of my career in New Mexico.
Okay, but you're skipping over your... Let's not skip over all this good stuff, okay? So Richie, of course, had been on staff at Bradley when you were there.
Yes.
You guys get fired. This is the way it works. As most people who listen to this pod know, it's all about your basketball family. Richie reaches out to you, and he says, come be on my staff at Oregon State. So did your wife find a house? Were you only you out there?
We did.
She stay in Peoria? What happened?
No, we went out and we did find a house, and we were in the beginning stages of purchasing a house. And I think we were there maybe 2 days and everything was fine. And I go back to Peoria, and then there's the Final Four. The Final Four happened. And then it became crazy because Richie was then approached by New Mexico at the time, and I think it was Rudy Davalos. Rudy Davalos was the AD, and Richie called me one night and said, "Hey, did you sign your papers for the house?" And I said, "No, but I was about to." He says, "Well, you better hold off because I think we might be going to Albuquerque." I'm like, "Oh, okay." And I think I was in Lowell's at the time, you know, trying to get some items for my house in Peoria, and because I knew I was going to move, so I was going to have to tidy up some things. And I could remember looking at my wife, and this overwhelming sense of stress just kind of clouded her face. And I just told her, I said, "Honey, it's going to be okay." So then we ended up going to New Mexico, and you know, there were some other things that took place, obviously, because we had that situation with Danny Granger. You know, that was something that I can't, you know, not talk about. But, you know, you mentioned that Danny Granger was one of the best players that we had ever had at Bradley. And then all of a sudden, I leave. And then the following year, he has this tremendous first half of the year. And things just didn't work out for him. And then he leaves. And then he leaves and ends up at New Mexico. And so if anybody's following the story, they know that there was a lot of NCAA confusion that took place with all that. But at the very end, nothing really happened. and everything was fine. And Danny was able to transfer successfully to New Mexico, sit out a year, and then go on to have a very successful career there in New Mexico. So look,
this is a perfect opportunity. Okay, so let's start with the beginning. First time you saw Danny Granger, was it in Metairie, Louisiana? Where was it?
So it was actually, ironically, it was in Dallas, Texas. It was in Dallas, Texas at a AAU event. Mike Kunstadt, who is a longtime talent scout, he runs Texas Basketball Review. When he was just starting out in the business, he would put on these showcases just like your father would and like Dinos in California would. He just would run these showcases here in North Texas, and he would get the best local AAU teams as well as teams from Arkansas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and in some cases, Kansas. And so I had a buddy who lived in New Orleans, and he told me, hey, there's a kid from Grace King High School that you should go see, and his name is Michael Suggs, okay? I said, okay, I'll go check him out because I trusted this individual. As a matter of fact, this individual was now the head coach at the University of New Orleans, okay? It's Mark Schlesinger. And Mark told me, go see this kid named Michael Suggs. I'm like, okay. So this is a Friday afternoon. I get into town, and I hustle over to North Texas, and I get my spot, and I'm watching Michael Suggs. Michael Suggs is a 6'6", 6'7" guard, left-handed, fairly athletic, and can really score. So I'm watching, but I'm not really focusing on him. I'm focusing on this other individual because the other individual was playing really, really well. He happened to be 6'9". He was long. He was dribbling, passing, and shooting and blocking shots. And I'm saying to myself, well, who is this kid? So it turns out that Danny, who I was looking at, not Michael Suggs, was the person that I should have been watching. Danny and Michael Suggs are cousins, and they played high school basketball together. So I just happened to see Danny perform at such a high level, and I knew back in the Missouri Valley, there really wasn't a player like Danny. And that's what intrigued me so much about him. I thought, okay, if a player like that gets into the Valley, it's almost like, you know, catching lightning in a bottle because he's so versatile. He can play inside, he can play out, he can block shots, he can guard the post, he can guard the perimeter. And on top of that, he was very, very, very bright, and he wanted engineering. And Bradley at the time was known for engineering. So the recruiting process started when I saw him in Denton, Texas, before his junior year in high school. And the rest turns out, I mean, he ends up being a pretty good player.
Okay, so you're at Oregon State for 2 months, and Richie comes in.
Well, it wasn't quite 2 months, like 2 weeks, actually. I'm sorry.
And Richie comes in and says, we're going to New Mexico. And you're like, okay, giddy up. You go to New Mexico. When did take me through, what was the process like then? Because now they get the transfer portal, you know, but this is, I mean, like, look, you kind of got to tiptoe. It's your alma mater. On the other hand, it's also the place to fire you. And look, you're trying to get it going at New Mexico. If you can get a player that you recruited, you go do it. How did it really go down?
Well, and here's the deal. In no way, shape, or form are you asking me to disparage the place that I went to school. I know you're not asking me that. So
no.
These are just the facts, okay? These are just the facts, okay? Yes, at the time I was ambitious, okay? At the time I was ambitious, okay? So you're thinking, okay, brand new assistant coach, you're trying to make a splash. This place is known for winning, all right? But it didn't go down that way, Doug. It didn't go down that way because at the very end, remember, at the very end, nothing really happened with the NCAA. And you and I both know the NCAA is very thorough in what they do, okay? Really what came about of that was just basically a strong enough relationship that Danny felt comfortable so that because there was no transfer portal and all this other stuff that goes on today, Danny just left Bradley. He just left Bradley. Now, I know that may be hard to believe, but he left Bradley, and he had nowhere else to go. And so he comes to New Mexico. And that's how it worked. That's exactly how it worked. So that's the story.
How come you didn't take Michael Suggs? Poor Michael Suggs, his cousin. He's like, hey, well, I can't go to New Mexico too?
No. Michael Suggs is on scholarship at Bradley, and he decided to stay because that was in the best interest of him.
So you get Danny Granger. And for people who don't, mm-hmm. I mean, I think people now, because Richie is at Liberty, and I covered you guys some mm-hmm. there, like mm-hmm. Richie, and of course he reinvigorated his career working under Tony Bennett. And
right.
like there are lots of people who are, I would, for a lack of a better term, false prophets, right? Guys that have a Bible in one hand, but the other hand, you have no idea. Like, Richie appears to be the real deal. What is that like to work for somebody who is so full of faith that there is no question about how you do it in terms of doing it the right way? Like, look, New Mexico has not always, before you guys got there, been accused of doing it the right way. I think Fran did, but there's some other stuff before that. But Richie is a... I mean, Richie's the real deal, isn't he, in terms of not just his faith, but also practicing it?
No, he's authentic. He's authentic. And because of that, you know, he and I had a very trusting relationship. And he looked out for me, and it was a really good situation. So, and he has never wavered on his faith. He has never wavered on his character, nor his integrity. And so it was really, really good. It was really, really good. So
obviously, you guys were great when you had Danny. Why couldn't Richie sustain it there?
Well, you know, I think as the story goes, he may not have been to Mexico's first choice or second choice.
Right.
And so, when you're not the first or second choice,
But didn't they want Bob Knight then? When they hired him? There was a rumor they were going to get Bob Knight, and then Bob Knight ended up going to Texas Tech. I think, right? Like that feels like around
that
the same
time.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know. I think, I don't know. It was somebody. It may have been Bob Knight or it may have been somebody else. But I think they thought they were going to get Rob Evans. Uh-huh. And I think they had solidified plans to hire Rob Evans. And then the next day, everybody in Albuquerque wakes up and it's Richie McKay. So I think that's kind of the way the story went.
So Richie gets fired, but you didn't leave. Okay, so for people who haven't heard this story, this part of the story amazes me. So Richie gets fired. Why didn't you go find another coaching job? Why did you stay?
Well, I made a choice. I made a conscious choice and decision to try to create a stable environment for my family as opposed to chasing my ambition as a coach. And at the time, my wife and I felt like Albuquerque was a good place to raise our children. You know, they were in school. She was happy. Everything was working. My parents were in Texas. I was a little bit closer to home. And so we just decided, okay, we're going to try to make this work. And so I went to the administration there, and I said, I don't know if there's anything that you can do, but if it can be worked out, I'd like to stay. And they made it work. And so I ended up working on campus, teaching a class, working basically in fundraising, and then doing some outreach for athletics, and then also doing some things for enrollment services, like actually going out throughout the state of New Mexico and recruiting. And so I had a number of different jobs so that my salary could work. And it was hard work, but it was probably, honestly, before I got back into coaching, it was probably one of the most fulfilling 18 to 24 months of my life from a professional standpoint. And my family, in that span of time, grew closer together. My kids were able to enjoy a stable environment. And it was good. It was much needed. And so that's what I did. I made the choice to be with my family and to make sure they were stable. as opposed to ripping and running all around the country.
Right. So how did you end up on staff with Steve Alford?
So Steve, during his first year, and I had known Steve because of his Missouri State days and my Bradley days. We competed against each other, so I was very familiar with him. As a matter of fact, the Deion Jackson player that you mentioned, and you can do the research on this, in the Missouri Valley Conference tournament one year, Deion Jackson basically throws up a Hail Mary prayer shot, three-point, and it goes in, and it beats Steve's team to go to the championship game against Tulsa in the Missouri Valley Conference championship. And I think that was 95, or I can't remember what it was. But anyway, so I had known Steve for quite some time, and I had known his staff. He had movement on his staff after his first year. Director of Operations opened up, Doble Spot. And so I had been talking to Craig Neal just because I knew him and we had a relationship. And then Chris Walker was also on his staff, along with Ryan Miller, who I work with now. But Chris Walker and I grew up together. Chris Walker and I played in the same AAU program in Houston, Texas, growing up. Okay, and so Chris and Craig, I think, started talking to Steve. And to this day, I thank the both of them. They're great men to have done that. So Steve calls me and says, what do you want to do? And I says, what do you mean? He says, do you want to come join my staff? Because we could certainly use you. And I'm like, sure, coach. And at the time, it made sense for me to be the director of operations because, again, I had small children, and I just wasn't ready to get back on the road right away. But being the director of operations kept me close enough to the game where I thought I could still have the same impact with the players, still enjoy the game of basketball, which I love, and grow my career in a different direction and learn something new. And so it made sense without having to travel as much because I didn't have to recruit. So that's why it made sense to go back with Steve. And the relationship from there just grew tremendously. I mean, he and I forged a great, powerful relationship to this day. I mean, he's probably one of my best friends. I mean, he's a good man. So
Because when I switched from ESPN to CBS, my first year at CBS was your guys' last year. And it was the end of a run. Where you guys won the league 4 out of 5 years, which is virtually unheard of. And for people who forget, right, that's when San Diego State was close to their peak.
Pretty good.
You're talking, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they were, and you guys were tremendous. Nevada was up and down. Nevada was down a little bit then. UNLV was very good. They had pros. It was a really, really good league. And BYU, before they left the league, was very good. What's the secret to Steve's success? Because I think people will look at the UCLA thing, and even though he won 30 games 1 year, 28 another. You know, there'll be people who say, well, Steve Alford didn't do what he's supposed to. Like, look, what you guys did in New Mexico is unbelievable. How? What by your estimation, made that New Mexico run possible?
Well, you know, I think Steve was really big on preparation. And I think he was very good at preparing our young men for the right things in games. And our young men were never really shocked at what took place in games, and they were able to perform, whether it was home or away, at such a high level. And then you throw on top of that being very fortunate to grab some high-quality recruits that stayed, and we got older, okay? Stayed and got older. And you may not remember this, Doug, but Steve's first year – he won 20-something games, okay?
Right, 24.
There was 24. There was talent there. We just needed a different direction in leadership. That's just how it works, okay? So the program had already been jump-started, and then he adds some young players plus some transfers with a system that was able to get up and down and play and defend and you have this amazing crowd behind you, I think it created a lot of momentum. Okay.
Well, you had this. You had this weird thing. Your second year, you had something that was really interesting. You had a couple of your best players from Albuquerque, right? Which, like, look, New Mexico is already a. If you haven't been to the Pit when they're good, I would challenge anybody to find a better environment. The place since it's been redone is perfect. Obviously, you got altitude, but more than anything, students are always nuts, right? And every place has a guy like Snake, right? They all have a play guy like Snake who's on. But the locals there are crazy. And then when you had, was it Chad Topert and Daniel Ferris?
Topert and Ferris.
To go with Tony Dandridge, like you got a couple of local kids who are playing. That place was bonkers.
Oh yeah. And those kids were around 4 years. Right? They had name recognition and people knew of them and they were good players. And we also had a young man from El Paso, Texas named Ramon Martinez who was pretty good and he was with that group. You know, and then like I mentioned before, we had a couple of transfers. So you had Jared Giddens in that group. And that was Steve's first year obviously, but again, I just think there was such a massive following and Steve just hit it at the right time and created a lot of momentum. So
there's a couple guys I want to ask. In terms of, because one of the things I think you guys did a really good job of is player evaluation, right? It's because like, look, Tony Snell's from Riverside, right? He became a hell of an NBA player, but he wasn't crazy heavily recruited. You weren't fighting UCLA for him, you know?
No.
Take me through the evaluation process of somebody like a Tony Snell.
So, Joaquin Jones, who was a former coach at Cal, was on our staff at the time at New Mexico. And he had connections, because before that, I think he was the grassroots director at Nike. Now, I may be saying it wrong, but I think he did something to that effect. So, he had... He had a wealth of knowledge about players from, in particular, Los Angeles, because that's where he's from. So Tony Snell, along with Kawhi Leonard, along with Jamal Franklin, they all grew up together. They're all very, very good friends. And they were all out in the Riverside area, or I think the San Bernardino area of California, which didn't get a lot of recognition then. It just didn't, you know. It just didn't get a lot of recognition. And we were fortunate to be able to bring him on campus. But again, Tony Snell was long. We could see that offensively, running him off screens and being able to rise above the defense and shoot, and his feel for the game in terms of what he could do off the dribble, could probably work in our system. Could probably work. And when Tony first got there, he was attempting to get his academics in order. So he didn't play the first semester. And Tony and I spent just about every day of that first semester building our relationship. So now there was a trust, you know, because he wasn't a real sociable kid, Doug. He just wasn't. But again, I think that's why the Albuquerque environment was good for him, because people embraced him for who he was. And at the time, the expectations for him weren't very high. So then he was able to grow into his role. And it worked. And we put him in a place where he could be successful. We had an offensive and defensive system that highlighted what he can do. And he lifted weights. He became a better student. And the rest is history. And that's how it worked.
You had a kid named Cameron Bairstow, who was an Aussie. Made the NBA, which is crazy. What was when he first showed up on campus in New Mexico, what do you remember?
I remember a kid that was very hungry, okay? And Ryan Miller, who was on our staff at TCU, was the lead on that. And he had some connections over in Australia, and I had a couple of myself. But when he arrived on campus, I mean, he was hungry for everything. He was hungry for food. He was hungry to get better. He was hungry to get stronger. I mean, he was hungry, Doug. Every day, every day after practice, he would take advantage of getting in the gym to lift weights and then going and getting to the hydrotherapy pools, okay? Showing up on time, doing everything. He just wanted to be a player. At a time when his physicality was at a premium. Like, he was the most physical player we had, and we were playing in a league that at the time, I don't recall it being that physical. It was a good up and down league at times, and guys could score, and there was some talent there. But a person that was really physical, and see, that was his superpower, and he worked at it. And he worked at it for 4 years, and I think that's why he made the NBA. And he just was so hungry to be a great player.
So Steve signs a 10-year contract. You guys won the league. I called the game where you lost to Harvard, obviously, and I thought,
you're right.
I think it was Bairstow who got into foul trouble, and they went small on you. And what was it? Laurent Rivard or whatever end up hitting a bunch of threes on you guys. But you come back
from
home.
The corner, the ball screen defense was a little shaky.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, I thought you should have gone small, and he kept one. Steve wanted to stay with his strength and play with your bigs. Anyway, right. He signs a 10-year contract. You're like, all right, you know, I've been here through two staffs. I stayed even when I wasn't a coach. And then all of a sudden he's like, no, I'm going to go to UCLA. What do you remember about when Steve said, I'm going to UCLA?
Well, let me see. It was about 10 hours, okay? It was about 10 hours. So Steve called me at 9 o'clock at night. It was on a Friday. And so 10 hours prior to that, I had gotten a call from a buddy of mine in Los Angeles who's an agent. And he said, hey, you know, you need to get ready for this because I think you're moving to Los Angeles. I said, well, why did he move to Los Angeles? Because he told me at the time that he thought Steve was going to be the next coach at UCLA. I'm like, yeah, whatever. That's exactly what I said. I said, whatever. So I hang up the phone and I go on about my day. And then at 9 o'clock at night, Steve calls me and I think something's wrong, Doug. Something's wrong because I would talk to Steve all the time, but typically at night he wouldn't call me because that was family time. It was family time. So he calls me and I think something's wrong. And then he just tells me, he says, look, we've had a tremendous run here at New Mexico and it's been great for everybody. Okay. But it's time to move on and I'm going to go to UCLA. And at that particular juncture, when he said that, the next words that were getting ready to come out of my mouth were going to be, well, congratulations, coach, you deserve it. Hey, good luck. But I didn't have a chance to do that because he said, and you're coming with me. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then he hung up the phone, and then we met the team the next day. That's exactly how it happened. And I told my wife, and then it's like, oh, okay, here we go.
Okay, it's exactly fascinating, though, because you go from not being on his initial staff
right.
to the DOBO, and obviously Noodles, right. Craig Neal, end up staying behind and getting the job. But to be going, you right. were the only guy he took with you. That had to mean an incredible amount.
Oh, it meant the world to me, Doug. It meant the world to me that he would consider me for a job of that magnitude. It meant the world to me. It spoke volumes about what he felt and what he thought about my ability and my character and the job that I could do. So, it was quite an honor, and it made me feel really, really welcomed and a part of his family for real, you know? So it was good. I was very pleased, and it was a privilege to do that for him to ask me.
You go to LA, and now all of a sudden you're in LA. And this isn't what you had been a part of ever in your basketball life, where
right.
everywhere right. else you have to hope that somebody else doesn't want the kid that you are going after. At UCLA, you can pick, you know, any handout that has the top 10 kids a position, you pick from the top 10. What is the difference like in trying to recruit at a UCLA? Also, but look, now, LA, you know, my brother, when he was at Cal, Mike Montgomery's like, you don't want to have too many LA kids. LA kids, are they all, the parents have an angle. They want a reality show. Just this too much. What was that like for a kid from Sugar Land, Texas, by way of Bradley, by way of Albuquerque?
it was everything that you would expect it to be, Doug. I mean, it was basketball on a world stage. It's a historically rich, tradition-oriented place. expectations out of the roof, and rightfully so. And so it was daunting, to say the least, to walk the grounds of Westwood and of the campus and to be in Pauley Pavilion. It was quite an experience. So much so, and I tell this story to a lot of people, every day that I was at work there, before I would get out of my car, you know, I'd have to say a prayer, because it's one of those jobs that it demands the very best every single day of what you have to offer. And I've always been that way. I'm always going to give 100% no matter where I am. But I think there it became more crystallized, because now everybody was really watching. Everybody was watching. So, but it was, and it's not a but, I shouldn't say but it was a very unique and fascinating experience for me. I enjoyed it. It was good.
I got to ask though, like, you go mm-hmm. from New Mexico, and in New Mexico, when mm-hmm. you guys had it rolling, you guys would roll into Thomas and Mack Center at UNLV, and it would be like the pit, right? You had incredible fan support.
Right.
Now you go to UCLA, where they got more banners than anybody, and it's really hard, even though the building is brand new, and it's UCLA, and it's Steve Alford, it's really hard. Until you had Lonzo, it was really hard to draw people. What was that like for, especially for Steve, not just you, but for Steve, a guy who, like, dude, he's Indiana schoolboy legend. He had sold out high school games with more people than UCLA games. What is that like as a staff to process?
Well, I think you just, we had to get accustomed to the fact that sometimes, because of the game times and because of the LA traffic, you may not have people at the beginning of games. But typically, if I recall, during the first year, especially when we kind of started winning, our crowds were pretty good toward halftime and beyond, okay? But that wasn't the amazing part about it, though, Doug. The crowd, that's one thing, okay? But we can't play for the crowd, correct? We can't. We have to play to win and have to coach our guys. What was the most amazing part to me was sitting on the bench and looking on the floor and saying, wow, you know, there's like potential NBA players on this floor, and I have a chance to coach these guys. That was the most fascinating part to me.
Were they as coachable as the New Mexico guys?
Oh, no question. And the reason I say that, and you'll probably agree with me, guys that are coachable and guys that work together typically can win. Okay, they typically can win. Ben Howland had put together a great recruiting class, and he had great players there. Okay, they just happened to buy into what Steve was talking about. All right, we won 28 games that year, so it was working, and they were coachable. They really were coachable. And I think at that stage, and maybe this is not the case because I haven't been everywhere, so I'm not trying to generalize. I just know about the kids we had there that first year. The kids we had there, they were open to everything, and they listened, okay, from Kyle Anderson to Norman Powell to the Ware twins to Jordan Adams to Zach LaVine, you know, Bryce Alford, you know, Tony Parker. They listened, and it worked. So just going back to my original thought, that was the amazing part, to be in a program where you actually have a chance to coach that type of student-athlete. It was amazing. It was truly amazing.
How come? I always felt like when Steve's teams at New Mexico were tough, as you pointed out, Bairstow, rugged. You guys were great and physical defensively. It felt like, and obviously this is after Lonzo and Bryce graduated, but it always felt like you struggled to get that same sort of physicality defensively. Was it the type of kid? Was it you didn't have a leader that was tough? Why did? Because Steve's teams were tremendous defensively, and yet when you got to Westwood, they weren't the same. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think it probably had a little bit to do with us being just young. I think that's what it ended up being, Doug. I mean, after Bryce and Lonzo and that group left, and we became really, really young. You know, we didn't have. We had very few juniors. I don't even think we had any juniors on that fifth year team. I don't know. You can probably look at it right in front of you. I can't remember, but I think that was part of it. You know, just having players that were young and talented but not understanding what it took to win at a high level consistently. Okay, that's what I think was happening. And that ended up being probably our demise, to be honest with you. So not getting old enough.
What was it like to coach Lonzo?
Lonzo was, he was, you know what he was like, Doug? He was like, you know, when you were growing up and you and Greg would get together and mom and dad would get you a toy like a car and you just wind it up and you just let it go. That's what it was like. You just gave him a couple of instructions. And because of his feel for the game, you never really worried about him making the right play, whether it was on offense or defense. And if he happened to make a mistake, you knew that he was probably going to do 16 things better the next time. So it was coaching at a level that really wasn't stressful when he was on the floor. I mean, he was able to interpret to a T what Steve wanted, and he was able to convey that in his own way to his teammates. And it just worked. I mean, it worked. He knew exactly what play to make and when to make it. And he had been playing on such a high level up until that point, and he was playing with all these expectations because, I mean, as you know, probably since the time he was ninth grade, the spotlight was on him and his family so much that he just embraced it. And so when he got to UCLA, it was just the next step. It just was the next step. And so coaching him, that was a treat. That was really a treat to coach him. He was phenomenal for us.
What was it like to coach Lonzo with LeVar? Like, did you guys, when LeVar said you guys are going to win a national championship, when he complained about other guys on the team, you know, specifically about Bryce and white kids playing defense, what was that? What was that like?
I think LeVar in particular, and I know him and I love him. And I know him and love him simply because in the recruiting process, we had spent so much time together. Okay. And I knew exactly what he was trying to do. Okay. He was promoting, which is perfectly fine. The next day when he would make those comments, he would call me and he would just laugh about it. And we would just shrug it off and we would just try to maintain focus with our team. That sort of stuff didn't start happening until later in Lonzo's freshman year. And at that time, we couldn't really focus on that, Doug. We had to focus on our team. Okay? So that's how we had to manage it. This is how we had to manage it. That's what happened. So
if you could make one different decision in terms of guys or things that, is there anything you felt like you could have done personally as Steve Alford's right-hand guy? Is there something you could have done to save it?
Well, you know, you have to have heavy shoulders to coach there, right? You know, I think about it all the time. I do. I think about it all the time. And maybe being stronger and communicating to him what we needed to do, you know, in the areas of the game that we needed to focus on. You know, maybe getting older, maybe becoming more physical. You know, that's... And I probably should have stepped up and talked about those things more with him. But that would probably be it. So
now you work for Jamie Dixon, a guy who, yes, he's had super physical teams, right? He's coaching now at his alma mater, much like you coach it. What is Jamie like in comparison to the other men you've worked for?
You know, they're all very, very bright individuals. Okay. You don't get to the level of head coach and stay there for a long time without having a firm grip on how to coach the game and how to recruit it and how to relate to people. You just can't. And so Jamie's no different in that area. He's no different in that area. I think in practice, he is a fierce competitor, and I think he tries to put our young men in adverse situations so that when game time comes, nothing is ever a surprise. Nothing is ever a surprise, and I've noticed that about him. And the thing that I probably appreciate about him the most is he never lets you feel sorry for yourself, and he never allows you to make excuses. He never allows you the opportunity to feel like you can be complacent. He just keeps moving it forward. And that, to me, has been an area in my life in particular where I've needed to improve, you know, dealing with success. You know, how do you deal with that? Do you lighten up or stop working, or do you keep pushing? And being with Jamie for the past 7 months, I mean, it's been remarkable in that area. Remarkable.
What do you think you have to do to get that head coaching job?
Well, probably continue to win and continue to recruit well and just continue to pray, Doug. It's really out of my control. It's out of anybody's control. I mean, you know, it's sometimes it's a little bit of luck here. It's who you know there and where you're positioned. You know, and I don't worry about it as much anymore. I just go out and try to do the very best job that I can do. I try to represent myself and my family and the institution and the staff that I'm working with to the best of my ability. That's what I try to do. And if someone recognizes that and they see that my skill sets can help them be their head coach, then you know what? I probably will get an opportunity. If not, then that's okay too. That's okay too.
Let me go through these men that you work for. Jim Molinari, his greatest strength is what?
It's personal integrity. It's personal integrity.
Okay, as a coach, like, do you think, because, I mean, then I go Richie McKay, and you probably say the exact same thing. As a coach.
I would say Richie's compassion. I would say Richie's compassion, but if you're talking about, like,
as a coach.
Coaching, I would say his defensive prowess. I think he has a genius-like makeup when it comes to defense.
Okay. Because now everybody's loading up in the ball. It's kind of pack line. Did he force middle? Did he force baseline?
No, we played pack line. We were more pack line defense. We were more pack line defense. That's what we were, if I recall correctly.
Okay. Richie, what was Richie's greatest strength as a coach?
Well, I think Richie was the opposite. I think Richie has a phenomenal offensive mind.
Steve Alford.
I think Steve Alford understands how to teach motion at a high, high level.
Yeah. Steve Alford also
high level.
Yes. I mean, look, you guys really screened well. You moved well. It's a beautiful thing.
Exactly.
The screening part, to me, was the part that so few teams, you know, obviously Virginia wins a national championship and they screen the hell out of you. But I felt like you guys might have been, at New Mexico, you might have been the best screening team in the country. That was part of that physicality.
Read and react. He was, I'm just telling you, and rightfully so. I mean, he played for probably arguably one of the best pure coaches in the game, you know. So all that was, you know, it's funny too, because Chris Beard coached under Bob Knight, and Chris Beard runs incredible motion,
Unbelievable. Yeah. All right, Jamie Dixon. Something that surprised you about Jamie Dixon as a coach that you didn't know before you coached under him?
I think he understands great spacing on offense. Great spacing. And I didn't know that because I just kind of assumed that when I, with all of his teams at Pitt, and I watched from afar. And I know he was extremely successful, but you always would hear Jamie Dixon's teams are tough, you know, they're defensive oriented and all this other stuff. But when I got into practice and I started to understand what he was teaching on offense, I was amazed. I mean, he does a phenomenal job in teaching spacing, Doug. Spacing. And you know, that's that. And also, too, helping our players understand where the defense might be, and then you go make a move, you know, whether it's draw and kick or driving the second or third side or you swing the ball and here comes the ball screen and then you hit the throwback guy or the behind guy. It's been amazing to be a part of that. Amazing to be a part of that.
Coach you admire from you talk about from afar. Give me one coach you admire from afar.
Well, I don't know if he's coaching now. Does it have to be a pro coach or a college coach?
No, it can be anybody you want.
Bernie Bickerstaff.
Why is that?
Growing up in Houston, Texas, I was a ball boy for the Houston Rockets for 9 years. So I was a ball boy during the time of, from the beginning of Rudy Tomjanovich, Moses Malone, all the way to Ralph and Akeem. Okay, so I was a ball boy during that span of time. He was a coach with the Seattle Supersonics. And the way that he handled Xavier McDaniel and Dale Ellis was phenomenal, because at the time, Doug, when I was a ball boy, I was working behind the visiting bench. I did that for 8 years. Even when I was like as early as third and fourth grade, I was behind the bench. And so I probably didn't pay as much attention to the strategy of coaching and how he did it, but certainly how he challenged his players and how they respected him. And for that, he's always been one of the most admired coaches in my entire life. Because Xavier McDaniel was a heck of a player. You know that. And wasn't always easy to deal with. So.
No. Your personal, he doesn't have to be your best player, your personal favorite player you've ever coached.
I tell you. Probably can't quantify that in just one, but I will tell you this. I'll say this. Aaron Holiday is a very good player, Doug. Very good player. Aaron Holiday.
All right. Well, listen, it's been amazing to catch up with you. It makes me excited about watching TCU play, just because I know you and I got to know each other some. I know you got to know my brother some, and now all of a sudden I'm all in on where your next stop is. This has been remarkable, and I congratulate
you.
It's one of those things. It's one of those things. I think you have it, but I don't know if it's like. I talk to my brother about this all the time, and honestly, Jay Billis taught me this. Jay Billis said, "How old are you?" And I said, at the time, I think I was like 40. And he's like, look, you basically got to your about 55. Once you're 55 on TV, they're 60, they're kind of done with you. And if you can work, what we call work for your entire life, covering basketball or covering sports, you're not really working. And so, yeah, do you want to, like you said, your perspective is amazing, that if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen, right? If I don't take the next step in my career, but to be able to provide for your family while loving sports, specifically basketball, like we do, it's pretty amazing, right? And there are conversations like this and moments where you're like, I should have the kind of perspective that you have.
Thank you. Yeah. Sport is, it's a privilege. I mean, it's, at the end of the day, no matter how stressful it gets, no matter what type of problems you have, I've always reflected back on the fact that it's basketball, man. I mean, it's basketball.
Yeah, but how did that work at home, right? You're an incredible family man, and UCLA, as much as there was a lot discussed about your guy's future, it's not, sports radio is not as big. It's not like a small town where that's all anybody talks about. But I'm sure it affects you. How did you handle that as a husband, as a father, when people are talking about your job status?
Well, I learned a long time ago to compartmentalize my life, Doug. So when I came home and I drove on National Boulevard and I went under the 405 and was headed west to my house, all of my job stress went away with me. Period. That's what it was at UCLA. When I got up in the morning and got back on National to get over to Pico, when I drove underneath the 405, man, it hit me again. And sometimes my job would spill over into my house, but most times I tried not to let it bother any aspect of my family life, because I knew that just as my job needed the very best of Dwayne Broussard, my family also needed the very best. And so that was how I've managed it that way ever since I started coaching. And much like yourself, you grew up in a basketball family, been around basketball all your life, remember? So when I was in the third grade, I was in the NBA. I was a ball boy for the Rockets. So I saw all of that. I've been in basketball all of my life, too. And so you just kind of have to learn those things. And You know, I'm not saying everybody does it the way I do. I'm not suggesting that. But for me, I learned how to compartmentalize.
That's a hard thing. It's a great trait to have. Dwayne, have a great night. Thanks so much for joining us in the Old Ball Podcast, and looking forward to seeing the Horned Frogs.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Doug. Thank you for the opportunity, man. Okay? Good luck. Bye-bye.
Perfect, Dwayne. Thanks again.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
All right, my thanks to Dwayne Broussard. That was, I mean, just his life so far has been interesting. Can't wait to see what he does next. Obviously, got a huge weekend in college hoop. These conferences are, I mean, like, look, I was talking with a WCC coach, right? And obviously, Gonzaga is going to run roughshod over the bottom of that league. But the rest of the teams at the top, St. Mary's, BYU, the Pacific, San Francisco, Santa Clara, who San Francisco just beat, like, there's obviously three or so legit NCAA tournament teams, and maybe four. You know, Oregon with the big win over Arizona. Peyton Pritchard continues to make big shots and big plays, and I think, you know, Dana Altman, his teams almost always get better. Arizona does appear to be an NCAA tournament team. Arizona State with a big win over Oregon State. We'll see what they do against Oregon this upcoming weekend. Washington's falling on a little bit of hard times with, you know, losing your point guard to academics, kind of a weird time of year. Obviously, the quarter system could allow them to get him back. But, you know, I don't want to say, like, with Stanford coming from behind and beating them, it does feel like Stanford can be an NCAA tournament team. Washington can be an NCAA tournament team. And then you go with Arizona, USC. So that league's not terrible. The demise of West Coast hoops has been kind of greatly exaggerated. Obviously, the Mountain West, it's San Diego State's league to win or to lose. And New Mexico, who I'll see in person this weekend, you know, you have suspensions of two starters, J.J. Caldwell and Carlton Bragg. And those guys, you know, Bragg being back, but maybe the damage is done. So the Mountain West, I thought, was at least a two-bid league. You know, if New Mexico, maybe three of New Mexico, but Utah State just has not played well. Losing to UNLV, then obviously at home to San Diego State. Adding Nima Keita has not made them better. I think ultimately, obviously, it will. Anyway, fired up for this weekend in college hoop. I'll give you my thoughts maybe next week on the Kevin Durant thing. Just real quick on the Kevin Durant versus Kendrick Perkins deal is this. I don't think KD needed to go there. Like, Kevin Durant can, in fact, be a punching bag. But, like, what are we doing here where we're allowing a former teammate, and I like Kendrick Perkins. I don't dislike him. If somebody says you made the weakest move in the history of the NBA, switching from Oklahoma City to the Golden State Warriors, winning two championships in 3 years, two finals MVPs versus LeBron James. All right. Look, you're entitled to your opinion, but you got to take some pushback there. Like, that would be like me, you know, saying somebody made the weakest move in the history of college basketball, you know, switching from one school to another as a coach, and somebody coming after me about my free throw shooting or wearing my shorts backwards. Like, yeah, that happened. It's not that big a deal. People get super mad. Like, if you're going to talk shit, then you got to know the other guy's going to talk. Talking shit doesn't work to where, like, I talk shit and you go, like, that's a good one. Good burn, dude. So I think a little bit of this is two guys talking shit and Twitter getting caught in the middle of it. I think a little bit of it is Kendrick Perkins has now entered, I'm on Team LeBron, not Team KD. And it's Kevin Durant being overly sensitive. But I'm not sure I would disagree with Kevin Durant being sensitive. You know, like, he was the best player on earth for the last 3 years. Now he's hurt. People seem to have forgotten. And all they won't forget is that he left Oklahoma City, who somehow was up 3-1 on the Golden State Warriors. I would disagree with Agent Zero on Oklahoma City regressing. They added Victor Oladipo. It would have been Russell Westbrook, Kevin Durant, Victor Oladipo. And while they may not have had the shooting, I think they would have been better. All right, more on that upcoming in future episodes. In the meantime, thanks for listening both to the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, and of course, to this podcast, which is All Ball.